Welcome to International Women's Day programs at KPFA Radio. My name is Priya Das, and I'm co-founder and VP Programming Strategy at Mosaic America. I am privileged to be anchoring and presenting to you Gallorious for the next hour. Mosaic's Gallorious is about some of the glorious gals who were the first to achieve, create, claim, and then stand up and get others to rise up. Gallorious is an inspiring hour of the feminine continuum of courage and strength, a journey between cultures, generations, and across boundaries of any definition. A short introduction to Mosaic America. We are a nonprofit organization that strengthens communities, cultivates belonging, and catalyzes inclusion through intercultural and co-created art. Through our work, Mosaic defines and welcomes answers to the questions, who is American and what is American art today? Mosaic programs deliberately weave together current art forms being practiced in America today, such as folklorico from Mexico, Bhangra from India, the Chinese pipa, classical Cambodian, Western flute, the cello, flamenco, modern contemporary, spoken word, and jazz. We do this deliberately to educate and build familiarity between cultures, to celebrate our differences and the common threads that bind us, but most of all, to connect people to the place we call home, be it San Jose, Silicon Valley, California, or America. Mosaic's Gallorious weaves a thread through some of our own commissioned work and work that we support. We'll traverse today to the late 1800s to listen to an Indian in America through the work of spoken artist Shikha Malaviya. We'll understand laying claim to one's Chicana identity through the voice of Rosanna Alvarez. Wan An Vo will talk about using traditional Vietnamese instruments, among others, to narrate stories of love, loss, and life. Usha Srinivasan will talk about why Mosaic America is a path forward to cultivating belonging through strong, multicultural, American communities. But first, we pay homage to our Native sisters through Ohlone culture bearer Charlene Eigen Vasquez and her daughter Justina Pellafox. It has been an honor for Mosaic America to have been working with the Confederation of Ohlone people.
Hi, my name is Charlene Eigen Vasquez, and I am so happy to be part of this Gallorious radio project. What a great idea. I have with me today my daughter, Justina Pellafox, and she'll talk a little bit more about our family history. Our conversation will be really centered around the importance of sustaining your culture tradition and practices during this time of COVID. It's really going to be talking about the importance of why cultural preservation is so important and cultural practice and traditions is so important during this time of COVID. It's been just kind of a backbone to help people in our community maintain their mental and physical health.
Hi, my name is Justina Pellafox. I am from San Jose, California. I currently live in Stockton, California. I am the proud daughter of Charlene Eigen Vasquez. I am the granddaughter of Phyllis Flores, the great-granddaughter of Edna Hernandez, and the great-great-great-granddaughter of Frances Herman. I can trace my family history to Margarita Butron. She was an Ohlone woman who was born in 1750. And the reason why I say this is because I pay respect to the women that came before me because they are who I am, they are where I came from, and they are who my children are. So in order to pay respect to them, I say their names when I do my introduction.
Thank you, Justina. And that's absolutely true. So whenever we have to talk publicly, we try to give people the best image we can display of ourselves and remind people that there's a reason why we do the things we do today. And it really is a reflection of the past. We remember our ancestors because they were survivors. So if you know anything about California history, what you know is that there was a decimation of the Native American population. And even though that took place, even though the mission system came through and treated people horribly, the mission school system came through and stole children and treated the children horribly. And some of them, unfortunately, didn't make it back home, never returned back home. or never return back to their traditional ways. We, in our heart today, remember all of the history of our ancestors. We put it all into context so that it strengthens us for all the work that we have to do today. So today we're just kind of sitting at the kitchen table and we are creating some shell necklaces as we talk to you. If you know anything about the Ohlone culture and probably other Native cultures, what you know is that our prayers are in our regalia. Our prayers are in the necklaces that we make and the food that we prepare. So today we're making these necklaces and praying and talking to you at the same time just to share a little bit about who we are, where we are today, right now, contemporarily, and what we're thinking about for the future as it pertains to leadership roles, roles of strength, and the future of our children. COVID pretty much stopped everybody in their tracks, so it doesn't really matter what we were doing pre-COVID, and we can talk about that a little bit, but now we're pretty much stopped in our tracks, and the way I see it is that everybody's just trying to remain safe, keep sheltered, for the most part. Even though we talk about our physical health, mental health has become a huge issue. And I think it's really big for families and prayer communities that can't get together. So I'm just kind of wondering, Justina, how are things for you? And what have you been doing to help maintain just mental health for your family and your community?
While mental health, I'm personally dealing with my family during COVID. So what I'm trying to do is to keep that calm, to keep the fear out, to keep the anxiety out, because I need to stay connected. My children need to stay connected. My family needs to stay connected. And so we've been going on hikes and we've been going to secluded parts of the beach to be around nature as much as we can. And that little bit tremendously helps my family. I am truly, truly blessed to have been part of ceremony and to have that inner calmness developed in me. And I think without ceremony and without that developing in me, it would have been a whole different situation.
Can you think about one elder maybe that influenced you and that you think about as you're trying to instill some of these traditional practices with your children?
Well, I think with every elder I meet, I take away a little bit of something. So whether it is to listen to when somebody's talking, listen to what they have to say, no interrupting, and really just be in that moment. So when we're here in the house and we're with family, I've learned to be in the moment, to look at each other's faces and look at their smiles and look at their eyes. And with elders, they don't rush. They take their time. And so when I'm here with my family, I take my time and I try to teach my kids, take your time, enjoy the moment, listen to everybody laugh, watch their faces, look at their eyes. And just really helps. That also helps keep the calm in the family also.
I would say the same thing for our family, my little household. There's only two of us, two adults and two dogs. For us, it's time to retreat into ceremony, in our own little private ceremony, right? We live about 20 minutes from the beach. So we try to go there almost every weekend and offer some prayers for people that can't make it out there because they live too far or because they can't travel right now. We try to share prayers with those people. And sometimes they're alone and sometimes they're not alone, but that's not our job. Our job is not to only pray for a certain group of people. Our prayer is really for the community, the larger community who might need that. We also live near Hollister Hills. So if anybody knows Hollister Hills, that's the location of Indian Canyon. And I'm not saying we're going to Indian Canyon right now, but I will say that we're looking for that same environment. We want to put ourselves in the environment that we're most familiar with, that we're most comfortable with as we pray and think about our ancestors. Again, our ancestors being survivors, and now it's time for us to take up that call and to protect our traditions, protect our ways, to go visit those special places where we would normally go gather all of the things we need for prayer, the things that we need to nurture ourselves, the clean water that we used to find. We want to visit all those places, even though the world might be a little bit quieter in terms of travel and commute. I'm kind of wondering, Justina, while you're, you know, I know we're talking a little bit about the need to be protected and protect our families and our ways right now and walking gently on earth. Can you think of one thing that you're most proud of when you think about something that you've been able to do, accomplished, or maybe something that the kids have accomplished, we'll just say over the last year or so?
Well, I can say that it wasn't anything physical. It was it wasn't my children. It was my nephew who asked about ceremony. And because we are home, he asked. When he was little, we took him to a ceremony and he got to experience a different side than city life. And it was his first time. And I didn't even think that he had remembered in. And
he, how old was he then?
He was probably about, I want to say 10.
Okay.
And he had just lived in the city. He had known nothing else but the city. And I had took him to a ceremony and he experienced, there's another side. It's not just city and it's not just streets and it's not just where we live. It's rough. And so there's not just homeless people outside. There's another side. And I'll show it to you, basically. You're invited and I'll show it to you. And so I did. I took him to ceremony and he, I got to talk to him for a little while, maybe a couple weeks ago. And he asked, he said, Dia, is there any other ceremonies? Is there anything else going on? Is there... And it just really blew me away because I had only taken him to a couple events because I don't see him as often as I would like. And he remembers. And that makes me extremely proud. That lets me know that I'm doing something right, that I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. For him just to ask and for him to remember, I know that it's made an impact on his life. And if it's just him, that's fine. Because there's so many directions right now that you can go. And hopefully I'm leading him in the right one.
And how old is he now?
He'll be 18 in a month and a half.
Wow. So I think kind of the important thing here is, and we've come across, you know, whether it's Justina or I or anybody that's out there listening, is we've come across a lot of young people. And sometimes we don't know the long-term impact of the things that we do. In this case, you know, you were able to take him to ceremony and he remembered that, and now that he's older and now that people are scared and worried and people are trying to find a new direction, a safe way to be, one of the first things that comes back if you're ever in ceremony before is this place of love and protection, and where everybody is welcome and you're connected to the outdoors and you're connected to, you know, the wind and the water and all of the elements that are part of ceremony. So I know he's not the only person that you've ever taken to ceremony. So, mm-hmm. And I'm not going to ask you certainly to go down the list, mm-hmm. but it's just a great example of, you know, how you can mentor kids, how you can teach mm-hmm. kids. And it doesn't have to be just your own children. It's all the children mm-hmm. around you. We were having a conversation just the other day, and you were talking a little bit about why we do the things we do, oh, yeah. and the timeliness of our actions and the thoughtfulness of our actions and why it's so important to pay attention. Maybe you can share a little bit about that.
Well, when I was younger, due to like the mission system and the culture getting lost, a lot of Native people in my shoes didn't grow up absolutely into ceremony. They had to learn it and they had to research it and they had to find people that knew the right way, the safe way. And so as a teenager, my mom found that way. And you showed it to me and my brothers and sisters, and me being from the city, going to sweat and ceremony. You know, I had friends. I wanted to be with my friends, but I went. I went and I listened. And my mom would always say, you know, this isn't for you. This is for seven generations before you and seven generations after you. And so, yeah, I would hear that all the time, all the time. And then now that I have children and I'm thinking about COVID and how we're stuck and I'm trying to keep the peace and I'm trying not to let anxiety into the house, that comes into my mind very, very strong. When I was there in the sweat, when I was there in ceremony, it wasn't for my mom. It wasn't for me. It was for my daughters and for my children. And it's going to be for their children so that if something like this were to ever happen again, they have the tools to deal with it. They have my mom doing the work. I'm doing the work. So they're prepared. And I know very confidently, like if something were to happen again with my children and I'm not here, they'll know what to do. Because it does. It reaches seven generations behind you. They were doing this for me, and I'm doing it for them. Children's children. I'm doing it for my nieces and nephews' children. I'm doing it for people who just happened to go to ceremony that day and be an observer. You never know who it's going to impact. And if it were to stop today and I stopped doing ceremony today, what's that impact going to be? And I'm not saying that people are going to be lost wandering the streets, but maybe they will. Maybe they will. And maybe they won't know how to handle certain situations. It's up to us. It's up to me. It's up to my mom. It's up to my children to keep it going, to keep it strong for their family down the line.
And the other day when we were kind of talking about this concept, one of the things that we talked about was, you know, for sure it, you know, you're thinking about these things and one of the things we were taught was, you know, we don't need to pray for ourselves because other people are praying for us. Mm-hmm. And the fact that seven generations ago, people were praying for us. They were praying for the future. When they were praying for the future, they were broadly praying for us as we sit here today. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about you're doing this for your children and your grandchildren and your nieces and nephews, the other thing that was mentioned was you're also doing this for the seventh generation in front of you, people that you don't even know yet. But people mm-hmm. that you have in your heart.
Yeah.
And that's really, really also very narrow because in our way of thinking, it's not even just for people. You know, we are doing all of our actions right now impact like all living things. So our actions today impact the future of water resources. Our actions today impact the future of the air, the future of the ocean and everything that lives in the ocean. So it just kind of goes on and on and on. And sometimes it seems a little overwhelming. So all you can do is kind of your little part. I would say for myself, since being locked down, having some extra time, I have a regular full-time job, but having some extra time to do some other things, you know, what kinds of things can we do to make a difference in the world, even though things are slow? I've been working on another project where I'm just doing research, a lot of legal research on land issues, Native American rights and land issues. We're pretty much, you know, doing legal research and writing some documents and some policies that we hope to put forth. But, you know, in some weird way, maybe, you know, this quiet time is a blessing in disguise where we get to reflect, where did we go to school? Why did we go to school? You know, where do we work? Why do we work there? Just a lot of reflection so that we make the best use of our time. And we start to think really about post-COVID. What do we really want to do? They can start thinking about the future so that they can make the very best of their lives. Thinking about, oh, I don't know, the next seven generations. Are you having the greatest impact on this world, in this world, with what you're doing right now? Or do you need to adjust a little bit because Creator put you here and you have whatever skills and talents and you want to make sure that you make the best of those skills and talents that you have, that you possibly can.
Thank you, Charlene and Justina, for this very reflective conversation. If you're just tuning in, welcome to International Women's Day programs at KPFA Radio. You're listening to Mosaic America's Gallorious. I am Priya Das, Mosaic's co-founder and VP Programming Strategy. And from talking about seven generations of the future, we sort of now will wind back the clock to the early settling of San Jose by the Vietnamese immigrants, African Americans, and the Chicano communities. This amazing project was a Mosaic commission called Love, Loss, and Life, which got community members and artist Vanna and Wu together to musically trace the history of the settling of San Jose. We will hear from both Rosanna Alvarez and Vanna and Wu.
We thank everybody who was a part of this project. The voices that you'll hear today are Adriana Rueda, Lisa Riley, Rosanna Alvarez, and Chuck Alexander. Let's meet Rosanna Alvarez, who is a multidisciplinary artist and lives poetically.
Rosanna, I'd like to start with you. You've said that identifying as Chicana is about your roots, but also acknowledging how rooted you are. Could you explain that, especially in context of the community in San Jose?
Yeah, I think, a lot of people mistake Chicana identity as being simply Mexican American, and there is no Mexican and or American about it. It's kind of its own flavor of sorts that does pull from a lot of our Mexican roots, but it very much has a lot to do with community. And in that sense, being rooted and grounded in who you come from and where you come from, with the understanding that you really do commit to this spirit of accountability to your community, this spirit of just community in general, and knowing that everywhere you go, you kind of represent who you come from. And so you have a duty to really do right by that and to think about social justice issues in ways that are more than the individual or the individual parts of what makes you you. And so when I'm teaching in Chicana studies and Chicano studies at State, the conversation we have about that is we are perceived as Chicanos with this external definition. And then we ourselves get to say, well, what being Chicana or Chicano means is a declaration. It's an affirmation. It really is this historical legacy that acknowledges that our history is complex and that our existence doesn't just require this expected resistance, but that we really bring in the heart of who we are into all of the spaces where we enter the room and it looks like you just see me. But really what I'm carrying with me is this collective fabric, this beautiful braid of a legacy of people that I have come to embody in a way. And so for me, that really is what the spirit of Chicanismo is, in that rooted sensibility.
And so we've talked before about how these braids of communities and cultures coexisting and living together sometimes doesn't happen naturally. And you had said something about Mosaic's deliberate programming helping that cause. And that was because?
Because I think that the layers of intentionality that you all put into this work really is what makes that work. And so there is a lot happening, right? And our community is vibrant and diverse and cross-cultural, and we worked throughout different periods of history in solidarity because we should, right? But the narratives in the mainstream, especially in these times, can be very divisive. And so art has that healing capacity. And I think artists are naturally drawn to each other, regardless of whatever lane other people want to park us in, because art and music speaks in a different way. And I think that that was the beautiful part about being in this project with Vaughn from the beginning, when she was asking us questions and had us crying in these interviews. And, you know, that in itself was a healing gift. And then to hear the entire musical piece come together in a way that does incorporate words, right? You can hear the voiceover integrated into that, but the composition of the music just does something that no amount of overthinking can ever do.
Cuando tú enfrentas el racismo, no permites que ese cáncer te absorba. When you confront racism, you don't let this cancer get to you.
As an African-American female, it was a challenge. I dealt with intrinsic racism.
Moving to California,
I saw it.
Made me realize how diversity is around you. Different languages, different skin colors, different nationalities, beliefs,
afforded
religions,
a good living, a good quality of life. And when I was able to buy a home, a condo here,
everything make us a beautiful, diverse spot that it makes us one.
My mom wanted me to go to school and get a good job and find a husband. I didn't find a husband here. I didn't find a husband. But I am finding a new me.
If you're just tuning in, welcome to International Women's Day programs at KPFA Radio. You're listening to Mosaic America's Gallorious. I am Priya Das, Mosaic's co-founder and VP Programming Strategy. A few minutes ago, Rosanna talked about the intentionality of Mosaic programming. Here to provide more perspective about the why we do what we do is president and co-founder of Mosaic America, Usha Srinivasan.
Over the past 3 to 4 decades, the Silicon Valley has experienced tremendous demographic shifts as it's transformed itself from a largely agricultural center to a high-tech hub. Today, only about a third of Santa Clara County residents identify as being born here in California. The rest are from elsewhere in America and from around the globe. And yet, even as we become more diverse, we're actually less socially integrated. Research from UC Berkeley's Othering and Belonging Institute has found that we are more racially and ethnically segregated now than we were 4 decades ago. At Mosaic, we believe that this is due to an outdated and somewhat flawed model of social integration that we here in America have relied on, the melting pot. It is the notion that people can come here from many different places from around the globe, and in this crucible of democracy and freedom, can forge a new uniform American identity. While this may have been a useful model for early waves of immigrants coming largely from Western and Northern Europe, who are white, Judeo-Christian, Anglo-Saxon, it is no longer a model that holds true for immigrants coming from Latin America and Asia. These immigrants belong to a wider range of religious, ethnic, and racial backgrounds. Further, communications and travel has become cheaper and faster, allowing new immigrants to maintain their cultural ties with their countries of origin. These factors, among others, combined to make it nearly impossible for newer immigrants of color to conform to an Anglo-centric American identity. This breakdown in the melting pot model of integration has led to social dysfunction in many communities across America, including right here in the Silicon Valley. No, there's no particular race or ethnic group that makes up more than a third of our population. We live in large groups of hyphenated Americans and immigrants in cultural silos where we eat, pray, play with others who are just like us. And while these silos themselves are rich With music, dance, cuisine, and other forms of cultural expression, the lack of interaction between people from different cultures creates the potential for tribalism, for an erosion of national identity, for a fraying of the social fabric, and a lack of sense of belonging to a community. At Mosaic, we believe we need to replace the melting pot with a newer model, one that does not require people to give up their cultural identity to become American. We need a mosaic. The tiles of a mosaic may come in different sizes, shapes, and textures, and are each beautiful by themselves, but it is the picture that they create collectively that is far more glorious. So how do we create this mosaic? In 2016, we launched Mosaic America, a grassroots movement that aims to strengthen communities by bringing together artists from different cultures to collaborate, co-create, and present works of art. Not just art that entertains, but art that fosters a shared understanding of the history of the land and creates uplifting experiences in the present. We curate works featuring artists from diverse communities, artists who are ambassadors for their cultures. We then present these works in community settings where people gather as they live their lives, in museums, libraries, parks, schools, and other community centers. Since 2016, we have presented over 250 artists representing 30 different cultures from across six Bay Area cities and reaching over 25,000 people. And we are just getting started. If you would like to join this movement to strengthen our community, please find us online at mosaicamerica.org. I'd like to take a minute to thank our funders, without whose support our growth and impact would not be possible. We'd like to thank Silicon Valley Creates, Applied Materials Foundation, Knight Foundation, California Arts Council, City of San Jose, and Hewlett Foundation. We'd also like to thank our key community partners, School of Arts and Culture at Mexican Heritage Plaza, the Multicultural Arts Leadership Institute, San Jose Museum of Art, and Montalvo Arts.
Thanks so much, Usha. That was Usha Srinivasan, my partner in crime at Mosaic America, and a great example of this outreach into cultures and communities is the project that we talked about before, Love, Loss, and Life, where we brought together Vietnamese, African American, Chicano, Chicana, and many other musical and cultural styles and people together. Here to talk more about the process is musician, composer, and Emmy Award-winning artist, Van An Vo.
Van An has performed in over 14 countries and was the first Vietnamese artist to perform at the White House under President Obama's administration and has received the Artist Laureate Award for her community contributions through the arts. And so, Van, in your music, you have sort of captured emotions of these stories as you talked with Rosanna, Leon, and many others. Could you just talk to us about your side of when you were listening to these stories, what was happening in your mind?
Yeah, so, I know that my experience is very different from the Black and Latin communities. My experience is even different from some of Vietnamese American communities member here because I came to America way later. Mm-hmm. So that is why projects like this are important to me, because the more I learn, I see that although we have distinctively different cultures and experience, but there is a common struggle that we face as people of color in America. In doing research to get inspiration to write music for 3Ls, I interviewed a lot of many different community members from all three communities like Black, Chicano, and Vietnamese community in Santa Clara Valley, I have to say that every single experience of everyone's so different, but the same at the same time. So and what I feel that I want to share the story of the people that I met and people that you know willing to share with me, I share that in my music. So I think that I you know because music is the air that I breathe. So music is how I share with others what I learn and so we can learn together. That's what I think. The music inspiration is from the story told by members of the African Americans, Chicano and Vietnamese community in Santa Clara. And I have my ensemble member who are not being able here today, but I have Misha Kalikulov on cello and bass, Joshua Mullinger on percussion and marimba, Jimmy Nakagawa on taiko drum and percussion. And the piece that I want to share with you, I named Double Up. So the, you know, Double Up describing an older San Jose still home to much racism and discrimination. The title of Double Up comes from an actual interview about San Jose in late 50s and 60s.
Came to San Jose in 1955 on a football scholarship to San Jose State. In that, it exposed me to San Jose. I heard about it on the radio. The coach realized I hadn't had my papers, so he was able to get me signed into the school. From there on, I participated in football. And we were facing integration, segregation at that time. We couldn't find housing. And so what happened, the coach was able to help us get the first housing. You know, because of the small numbers of African American athletes, then the next house, we had more African American athletes coming in. They couldn't get housing. So we got another house and we double up. And some would sleep in the day and work at night, and so we double up there, but we lost that housing. So we double up there with the ones at night who sleep during the day. Ones in the day during the night, but we lost that housing. At that time, San Jose was very segregated in housing and educational and also work. Thank you.
And now we shift gears to meet a nasty woman from the late 1800s through the voice of spoken word artist Shikha Malviya.
Namaste. My name is Shikha Malviya, and I'm a South Asian poet of Indian origin living in the San Francisco Bay Area. I'm so thrilled to be here today as part of the Galorious Project and share some poems with you all based on a phenomenal Indian woman named Anandi Gopal Joshi, who lived in the 19th century. There can never be enough women's narratives, and I'm so thankful that Mosaic America and its founders Usha Srinivasan and Priya Das understand this. They provided a fantastic platform to support and showcase diverse voices and make Mosaic a safe, inclusive, artistic space that engages with multiple communities. So thank you, Usha and Priya. The following historical persona poems I'll be reading are culled from a poetry project I'm writing on the life and letters of Anandi Gopal Joshi, known widely as Anandi Bai, who lived from 1865 to 1887. Anandi Bai was India's first female physician and the first Hindu woman to enter the United States, as well as pursue a medical degree. I first came across Anandi Bai's sepia-tinted photograph in a sari in 2016 while researching South Asian history on the web. I'd never heard of Anandi Bai before, and surprisingly, neither had my family nor friends. There she was, this petite woman, her lips curled in a hint of a smile, her hands folded in her lap, her eyes filled with fierce determination. I was riveted by her photograph and simply had to know more. Anandi Bai's life story, I found, was a compelling one of empowerment and of American and Indian allyship. She broke many traditions and social conventions to pursue an education and career held exclusively by men. Not only did Anandi Bai pursue an education in a time when Indian women were bound to the home, but she also traveled across the seas to do it, which was considered taboo in Hindu culture. Anandi Bai's story has often been told through the lens of her husband being her savior and inspiration. And while he did encourage her, it was often by coercion and violence. By telling Anandi Bai's story through poems in her own voice, my hope is to not only restore Anandi Bai's agency and give her story back to her, but to also highlight her inner strength, determination, sharp intellect, and her desire to help other women. The first poem I'll be reading is called Outside the Chaukat. Chaukat, which means doorframe in Marathi, is emblematic of the division between the world inside and outside the home, especially so in 19th century Indian society, which held on to their traditions and identity even more fiercely because of colonial rule and Western influence. Anandi Bai Joshi was born in Kalyan, Maharashtra on March 31, 1865, in a busy port town that is now a suburb of present-day Mumbai. Outside the Chaukat. If you want to know what happens in this bustling town by the sea, Kalyan, which in Sanskrit means well-being, but whose shores have thrice been plundered by the Mughals, the Portuguese, and the British, despite the shade of a fortress and a long city wall with four gates and 11 towers, whose welfare is erased and renamed Kalyan and Kalyan. Ask the men. For they are the ones who wear shoes that take them outside the chaukat. They are the lucky ones who, donning their turbans, smell the dung of many homes, hear the hum of horses' hooves, darken their hands with the ink of newsprint, read the khabar of the day while sitting on a zopara in the courtyard, dragging a puff from a gurgling hookah. Whereas the women tiptoe softly, their bare soles hardened, walking from kitchen to cowshed to well, fingertips charred from stoking the chulha, thoughts spilling over like water from vessels balanced on their heads, of what lies beyond a doorframe that make a splash and then evaporate. Anandi Bai was married at the age of 9 to Gopal Rao Joshi, a widower 16 years older than her. Gopal Rao was progressive in his thinking and was instrumental in encouraging Anandi Bai to pursue an education, though he resorted to extreme, sometimes violent behavior, such as beating her up to get her to study. Gopal Rao emphasized learning English so that Anandi could pursue her dream of becoming a doctor, which arose after she gave birth to a son at the age of 14 and lost him within 10 days because of lack of proper medical care. Anandi learns English. This new language is like balancing a marble on my tongue. The K in knife, silent. The T in brother, soft. Aji says, why learn the bhasha of the Angrez who don't bathe every day, who eat the flesh of animals like a jungli, and call us heathen instead, with our heads covered and our feet bare? But my husband, he brings me books in Aval Angrezi. He says I must learn it all, their language, their god, their modern ways, anything to help us cross Kalapani, to hold their alphabets in my mouth and swallow before they roll away. Torn between her husband's zealousness that she learn at all costs and the American missionaries in India who were eager to help with her education on the promise of converting to Christianity, Anandibai was determined to keep her identity and become a doctor on her own terms. Magnetism. My husband with his shaved pundit's head and white dhoti, and the Christian missionaries clad in black, despite tropical heat, are like two sides of a magnet. Opposing forces, yet united by the same zeal. One pushes to reform the mind, the other pulls to convert the soul. Do they not know of the center that holds? None of them ask me what the heart wants, while I hear it loud like a dhol rushing into my ears, beating for the women of my land. And with the stethoscope, I might hear it clearer. Dhar-dhar, dhar-dhar, doctor, doctor. Of which there are none from where I come from, of brown hue, clad in colorful saris, kunku pulsing on their foreheads like red crosses. Call it fate that Anandibai's husband wrote a letter published in the Princeton Missionary Review that reached an American woman in New Jersey while she was in the dentist's waiting room. Anandibai's desire to become a doctor and help the women of her land resonated with Mrs. Theodosia Carpenter, and they exchanged letters for 3 years before Anandibai boarded the City of Calcutta steamship to sail for the United States in 1883, where Mrs. Carpenter, whom Anandi now regarded as a second mother, would be waiting to receive her and give her a home as she pursued her medical studies. Riding the Meridian. Countless creases on these waters of ships traversing the ocean's face as the sun plays truant during our voyage. Mrs. X, my companion, draws notches in the back pages of her Bible of days and nights feigning prayer while eyeing my movements, wondering what is it this Hindu is reading, remarking how no book is as worthy as a black-bound one in her hands. Other passengers look at me unfavorably as I push boiled potatoes and limp vegetables around my plate, holding a fork and knife gingerly, refusing animal flesh. I ignore their whispers of how I should be in third class with the ayahs, and yet I wish it were so, for I would find less pretense there and more color in conversation, no threats of conversion. But in each lip of land our ship touches, I take delight. A different scene as if from a storybook. Ceylon's tall palms swaying, Egyptian soil gleaming red, and England's cottony clouds like an umbrella over our heads. With the sun's daily revolutions, we move further and further from the equator at the speed of 4 to 6 knots, my sari rippling in salty air as I inhale the scent of a new world. The seas neither black nor poisonous, but taking shape of the palm that holds it. How does that which has no color both bless and stain? And I think of Copernicus, who stood by his convictions, who knew the true meaning of circumambulation, how it is us that revolves around, what gives us sustenance, and not the other way around. Anandibai was admitted to the Women's Medical College of Pennsylvania in the fall of 1883 and was hailed for her bravery in defying tradition and religion while retaining her manners and customs. They call me Lady of the Orient. Though the darkest one in the room, I'm the brightest of them all, in a red pitamber sari, Team Pompeian, belle of this ball. And as I shake their hands, 500 pairs wearing gloves to protect me, they regard the spray of pearls hanging from my nose, my filigreed wrists of bangles glinting gold, the tiny kunku dot on my broad forehead, drawing stares and praise for this young Brahmin lady, so brave, having come all the way alone from Serampur to the city of brotherly love to earn her doctor's coat. Maze na vanandi ahe, I want to say, in my native tongue, so that I don't forget who I am. The young girl whose books once lay tattered in the cowshed, whose baby lived barely 10 days. I float like an Indian rose among a dull sea of cinched waists and bonnets in the parlor of the dean of the Women's Medical College, smiling till my cheeks hurt as they stumble out a new version of my name, Ananda Bai, remarking, "How exquisite is my English." Anandibai was received with much kindness by the American people, and she wanted to introduce her culture to them. Can you imagine that in 1883, in the town of Russell, New Jersey, Anandibai cooked a traditional Marathi feast of 18 dishes and served her host and their friends Indian style on makeshift banana leaves, seated on the floor, lending the women guests her saris to dress up, and teaching them all to eat with their hands. When the guests sup as gods, a ghazal. In my wildest dreams, never do I fathom tonight that I should turn them into feasting Indians tonight. Not those whose vast plains they call their own, but proud Marathas from my faraway native tonight. All the fair ladies draped in woven bordered saris, hands bangled, necks spangled, shining bright tonight, as they swish across the inlaid floor like princesses in my colorful trousseau that belongs to them tonight. 18 squares hand-drawn in red and white powder on the dining room floor where guests sup as God tonight, set with plates stitched from broad buttonwood leaves. A rich meal of spiced vegetables and fruit await all tonight. After a Sanskrit prayer blessing this feast is chanted, all eyes look up to me on how to proceed tonight. No spoons, no forks, nor knives, just their pale, bare hands, sampling 18 exotic dishes prepared by myself tonight. Fashioning small balls out of their food with pink fingertips, they pop them into their mouths like all of India does tonight. The meal ends with a serenade and sprinkling of rose water, bouquets of freshly plucked flowers given to each guest tonight. Oh, Anandi, see the red kunku and all their white foreheads, how the love of my new sisters makes this heart swell tonight. The next few poems give a glimpse of Anandibai's life in the United States as a student and as a visitor. Though she was constantly plagued with illness and was unaware she had tuberculosis, Anandibai approached all experiences with wonder and curiosity. Ebony, ivory, and silk. Over my doctor's white coat and the black beaded Mangalsutra that lay snugly against my chest as proof of marriage, tips of ivory in each ear, connected by tubes wrapped in fine silk, forming a parabola, a conduit of sound, from which hangs an ebony medallion, confirming proof of life through the steady gallop of beating heart and burbling lungs. And I wonder how this is not considered a type of precious jewelry as well, the stethoscope worn by a rare few of my sex. A visit to the springs. I will not let my pain interfere with anybody's happiness, not even my own. My body, still used to the tropics, unable to adjust, aches with every movement. And this headache, which is my constant companion, I ignore as we make our way through the countryside. In Troy, I try cucumber pickles that are unusually green. No one can tell me why, and I suspect they have copper in them. When I run a needle through a pickle, it turns bright red, and then I am satisfied. Someone remarks, "How this is my doctor's mind." In Saratoga, the women roam freely without their bonnets, and their hair, like fine silk, flutters in the summer breeze as they visit the springs. I find out that this is the land of the Iroquois tribe. I meet a squaw and we exchange notes on how different our Indianness is. As we part, she gives me a necklace of beads and calls me sister. I give her a copper 1/4 anna coin with Empress Victoria on one side. Crazy quilt work. Resourcefulness knows no nationality among women tending the hearth. We are mistresses of improvisation, magicians of the ordinary. Those fabric scraps whose warp and weft seem exhausted, we collect like leaves till they are plenty. A motley come together haphazardly. No symmetry, no intentional design, just hard-working fingers patching together what seems out of order. This crazy work, an American pastime, becomes this Maratha woman's way to pass a summer filled with anticipation and premonition. So much to be done, so little time to do it. These gifted blocks of cloth, beating bright with love and generosity, become a quilt that covers my unseasonal chills, my malaise for which no cure fits. The last poem is Return to the Motherland. 11 trunks accompany me home on the RMS Etruria, 8 of them purely souvenirs, dearest of them all, the crazy quilt of silk scraps gifted by those who held me to their breast in this ever-unfurling land without reservation. I cough with each turn of my pen. Even the least breeze seems to abuse me. I grasp onto each breath as if at the ship's taffrail, steadying myself for the journey back home, a gloom of goodbyes lingering over my head. Anandibai graduated from medical school within 3 years and returned to India in 1886. While she was criticized and maligned for wanting to leave India to pursue an education, on returning with her medical degree, she was celebrated and hailed as an example for other Indian women. Anandibai was to serve as the physician in charge of the female ward of Albert Edward Hospital in Kolhapur, but passed away from tuberculosis on February 26, 1887, at the age of 21. After being cremated, as per her wish, her husband sent her ashes to Mrs. Theodosia Carpenter in New Jersey, where they are interred in the Carpenter Family Cemetery in Poughkeepsie, New York. Anandibai's gravestone reads, "Anandibai Joshi, first Brahmin woman to leave India to obtain an education."
That brings us to the conclusion of Mosaic America's Gallorious. If you have liked what you've heard, find us online at mosaicamerica.org. Please stay tuned for more special programming